This is the start of the second session, which is a talk given by Conrad Buick on Robert Tressel and the Social Democratic Federation. Adam is going to talk for
25 to 30 minutes.
We're then going to have an orderly discussion through the chair, lasting until 6 o'clock. We hope there might be crucifixions on the meanwhile, if anyone gets out of line. Okay? That means you, Frank. There has been a collection. And it amounted to £73.60. Yeah. So thank you all very much. The room cost us £35. So we've actually made a profit. Right. So without
£35 for the last session, we need some more for this one.
Yeah. Right. So without further ado, and in good order, I present Conrad Buick to give his talk.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Conrad Chen. I'm going to take up the story where Colin finished, with the death of William Morris in 1896 and the subsequent dissolution of the Hammersmith Socialist Society. You know, by that time, as Colin explained, Morris was still favouring a policy of concentrating on making socialists, but had become more or less reconciled with the Social Democratic Federation and its policy of trying to combine this with campaigning for reforms to be achieved under capitalism. Now, Morris justified this on the grounds that this was what the working class wanted. This was the road which the working class movement seemed to want to take. I mean, he didn't agree with it, but he was prepared to go along with it, as I say, if that's what the workers wanted. Now, as we know, this reforms of capitalism and independent labour representation was the route that was taken. But whatever this did achieve, and it could be argued that it's done little more than allow men and women of working class origin to become professional politicians, John Prescott as Deputy Prime Minister, in other words, to break the monopoly on this of members of the ruling class. So I'll say, whatever this particular line of activity did achieve, the party that resulted was not a socialist party, but one that has merely replaced the old the Liberal Party as the alternate governing team to the Tories for administering British capitalism. So much so that voices are now being raised in the trade union movement calling for the founding of a new Labour Party based on the unions and pursuing a trade union agenda. Now this, in our view, would be a mistake, just as it was 100 years ago. I mean, I want to argue, as far as those who want to advance the interests of wage and salary workers and who want an alternative society to capitalism concerned, I want to argue that as far as these people, as far as us, we are faced with the same tactical choice as we were 100 years ago, between a gradualist labourite reformism and making socialists. But to return to the SDF, in the 1880s, it was largely composed, but not entirely, of deserters from the capitalist middle class, as indeed was the Socialist League and the Hammersmith Socialist Society. I mean, both Hyndman and William Morris were wealthy capitalists. But from the 1890s, the SDF began to recruit more and more of its members from the working class, from amongst the first products of the 1870 Education Act, which introduced compulsory education into Britain. Now, these new recruits were eager for knowledge, and especially about socialism and Marxist ideas, and a whole range of Marxist literature became widely available in English in the 1890s, including Marx's Capital itself, which Morris had to read in French, but also Engels's Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, and Marx's Value, Price and Profit. Now, these were distributed in England by the SDF, which was the organisation at the time of which the Marxists and Revolutionary Socialists were members, including, for instance, Eleanor Marx, until her death in 1898. However, the SDF also had a reformist wing and was still controlled by Hyndman and the clique around him. There was thus a simmering tension within the SDF between the young working class revolutionary socialists on the one hand and the Hyndman leadership and the reformist majority on the other, which was to come to a head in the early 1900s in what has been called the Impossibilist Revolt. But before coming to this, there is another episode in the history of the SDF, one which was decisive for its future, which in fact sealed it, which needs to be described. 3 years ago, the Labour Party celebrated what it claimed to be its centenary. In fact, the Labour Party did not come into existence as such until a parliamentary Labour group was established after the 1906 general election. Now, what did happen in 1900 was a conference of trade unions and so-called socialist groups, which set up the Labour Representation Committee with the aim of getting Labour MPs elected. Now, besides the unions, there were three political groups present: the Independent Labour Party, the Fabian Society, and the SDF. Now, of these, the largest was the ILP, who was led by Keir Hardie and Ramsay MacDonald, with about 11,000 members at that time, compared with, well, a figure I've seen mentioned of 3,000 for the SDF. Although it claimed to be socialist, the ILP rejected the class struggle and repudiated Marx. I mean, it's socialism, with or without inverted commas, was based rather on an interpretation of non-conformist Christianity, what they'd call in Glasgow come-to-Jesus socialism. Hence, a later Labour Party General Secretary's quip that the British Labour movement owed more to Methodism than to Marx. And the ILP's essential aim was, if you like, state control, state intervention, state ownership, in other words, state capitalism. The Fabians, too, were non-Marxists who believed that state capitalism was gradually evolving anyway, and that their task was to work with this trend. Now, at the conference, the SDF delegates moved resolutions to commit the new organisation to socialism and to the class struggle. Now, both proposals were voted down. In other words, the soon-to-be-born Labour Party wouldn't commit itself, even on paper, to the word socialism. It wasn't to do this, of course, until 1918, when it adopted the new constitution, including the famous Clause 4. Now, faced with this rejection, the SDF withdrew and was not present at the Labour Representation Committee's second conference in 1901, and so did not become part of the Labour Party. Now, it was this that was the momentous decision that must have consequences for the SDF's future. I think in about 1909, it changed its name to the Social Democratic Party, and in 1911, some dissident branches of the ILP joined it, and it became the British Socialist Party, which in 1921 was the main constituent part and provided the bulk of the members of the Communist Party of Britain when it was formed. Now, this decision to remain outside the Labour Party resulted from a convergence of conclusions between the Hyndman clique and those who had become the Impossibilists. Now, the reasoning of the two groups was, however, quite different. Hyndman was opposed to mere Labour representation, as it would exclude people like him from the so-called middle class from representing the workers in Parliament. Hyndman, in fact, held that the workers were not capable of emancipating themselves anyway without the help of middle-class leaders like himself. In other words, he had a proto-Leninist position, though expressed with more arrogance and condescension. He used to appear wearing a top hat and tails. But we should also remember that Lenin was a dissident member of the ruling class, even though he didn't wear a top hat and tails. It might be thought that people coming from this background should be a bit more discreet when commenting on the intellectual capacities of the working class. Now, the Impossibilists, on the other hand, they enthusiastically welcomed the decision not to join the Labour Representation Committee, since they realised that the solution to the problems facing the working class lay not in electing Labour MPs, but in socialism. Within a couple of years, however, war broke out between the Impossibilists and the Hyndman clique. It was, in fact, one of the Hyndman's people who called their critics Impossibilists as a term of abuse for those who were opposed to Possibilism as a doctrine. Stop it. So, to say, the term Impossibilism was coined as a criticism of those who were opposed to Possibilism, which was the doctrine that workers should concentrate on striving to get whatever small improvements were possible within capitalism. Now, on the continent, apart from France, where the term impossibilist probably originated, opponents of such possibilism were known as maximalists, which I think is probably a better term, because it's clear it's those who are demanding the maximum, those who are demanding the bakery, not the crumbs. It also echoed the division of the Social Democratic Party's program into a maximum program of socialism and a minimum program of reforms we achieved within capitalism. Now, the impossibilists in Britain were influenced by the American Socialist Labour Party, which in 1900 had dropped having a programme of reform, so had dropped having a minimum programme, and also by those in the Socialist Party of Canada who held a similar position. And matters came to a head when the SDF conference expelled a number of prominent impossibilists in 1902 and 1903. But the impossibilists, they weren't united or didn't stay united. And in 1903, those in Scotland broke away from the SDF to form the Socialist Labour Party of Great Britain on the same lines as the party of the same name in America. Now, those in London followed them out of the SDF in 1904 and founded the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Now, the SDF continued to exist and to try to combine propaganda for socialism with propaganda for reforms of capitalism, which it called Stepping Stones to Socialism. So at this time you had three organisations in Britain claiming to be Marxists and revolutionary socialists. I mean, all three envisaged using, among other things, the ballot box to bring about socialism, which meant, of course, that they were all committed to the idea that you had to have a majority before socialism could be established. Now, this tradition has been described as Anglo-Marxism. Personally, I must confess, I like the term, because I think it does describe well a broad approach shared not only by the SDF, the SBGB and the SLP in Britain, but also by the SLP in America and the Socialist Party of America with Eugene Debs and similar organisations in Canada and Australia. But where you may begin to ask, does Robert Tressel come into this? Well, Robert Tressel was the pen name of Robert Noonan, who was a member of the SDF in Hastings, which presumably you all know is a town on the south coast of England where a certain famous battle took place. So the Ragged Trouser Philanthropist was written by a member of the SDF, and the political views that were expressed in it are essentially those of the SDF. Noonan wasn't prominent in the organisation, he was just, if you like, an ordinary provincial member. And as such, a simple provincial member, and as such, not someone who would have followed the Impossibilist Revolt, which was mainly a Scottish and London affair. But I mean, this makes his views all the more typical of the SDF membership. Now, because of his book, he must be the most widely read SDF member today and over the years. I mean, who reads today Hindman or Belford Bass compared with those who read Noonan Tressel? I'm not going to go too far here, because H.G. Wells was a member of the SDF for a short while, and D.H. Lawrence used to hang around their meetings in Nottingham. Now, I don't know how many of you here have read The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, but if you haven't, I would urge you to, because it's a story of the life and activities of a section of the working class in England, a group of painters and decorators in a provincial town for a period of just over a year, sometime between 1906 and 1910. And one of these is a revolutionary socialist. Now, of course, living and working conditions have changed considerably, in fact, improved considerably since that time. But anybody who is a Socialist Party member will be able to sympathise with the main revolutionary socialist in the book, who's called Owen. Since what he was trying to do was to convince his fellow workers of the need for socialism as the only way out of their problems, but largely coming up against a wall of indifference and hostility, as those he was trying to convince either defended the capitalist system or said that he couldn't do anything about it. And this was, in fact, why Noonan gave the book its title. And it was the workers, according to him, living in miserable conditions of poverty, who were the real philanthropists in society for willingly allowing their capitalist employers to exploit them for profit. It's also why he called the town where the story is set Mugsborough. Now, there was a time in the 1980s when you asked a Labour MP what was their favourite book, they would reply, The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist. I mean, this is strange because the book is a plea for a revolutionary socialism in the Anglo-Marxist sense, not for Labourism. This is at one point, when the workers are discussing politics during their lunch break, Owen says, money is the principal cause of poverty. Now, the others scoff at this because, you know, for them, it's precisely the lack of money that is the cause of poverty. So, Owen goes on to explain in more detail what he means by the statement that money is the principal cause of poverty. Poverty consists in being short of the necessities of life. The necessities of life are all produced by labour applied to the raw materials. The raw materials exist in abundance, and there are plenty of people able and willing to work. But under present conditions, no work can be done without money. And so we have the spectacle of a great army of people compelled to stand idle and starve by the side of the raw materials from which their labour could produce abundance of all the things they need. They are rendered helpless by the power of money. Those who possess all the money say that the necessities of life should not be produced except for their profit. And this is due, he says, to what he calls, what we mentioned today, the money trick. You know, it's the land, that's natural resources, and the instruments of production all belong to the landlord and capitalist class. Wealth, in other words, useful things people need to live and enjoy life, can only be produced by work, by labour being applied to these materials that originally came from nature. But as both these and the instruments and machines to fashion them into something useful are monopolised by the owning class, workers can only gain access to them to produce things on the owner's terms, which are that they, the owners, as he says here, should make a profit. I mean, the owners pay workers a wage in return for them working for them, but this is always less than the value of what they produce, only enough to pay what the workers need to survive with their family for a week. Now, Owen shows that even when there's plenty of work, what we would call full employment today, workers are exploited. They spend all their wages in the week, and this goes on week after week without them getting any better off, while the employers get richer and richer all the time. And this is a rather simplified explanation, but it is the sort of thing that SBGB as well as SDF outdoor speakers would have been saying at the time. Owen, in fact, and this comes back at a discussion we had earlier, doesn't blame the capitalists or the employers personally. What he blames is the system which obliges capitalists to behave in the way that they do. I mean, competition between employers forces them to cut costs and keep wages down for fear of leasing out to their rivals themselves being reduced to the rank of wage worker. Owen calls the system the battle of life system, where everybody is competing against everybody else, and he blames it on landlords, and that is the land being monopolised by a minority class, and on competition between employers. As long as this lasts, he says, nothing much can be done to improve the lot of the workers. Now, this, of course, is an impossibilist argument. In fact, it's the classic impossibilist position. But Noonan was not a thoroughgoing impossibilist. Otherwise, he'd have been in the SBGB, not in the SDF. And he has Barrington, who is the other socialist character in the book, who turns out to be from a rich background, working as a painter just to see what it's like. He has Barrington list various measures to be achieved in the meantime, the measures such as public works, state maintenance of children, nationalisation of the railways, and also the SDF's policy of having a citizen army instead of a standing army. In other words, the SDF's stepping stones to socialism. I mean, obviously, from our point of view, this is the weakest part of the book. But even here, Noonan says that neither socialism nor these workers nor these measures can be realised unless the workers cease from voting for liberal and Tory sweaters, shareholders of companies, lawyers, aristocrats and capitalists, and you must fill the House of Commons with revolutionary socialists, that is, with men who are in favour of completely changing the present system, which of course I mean, clearly, this is not a plea for mere Labourism, merely filling the House of Commons with working men, irrespective of political views, or rather, irrespective of the fact that they were not socialists, and were, in fact, as was explained earlier, essentially liberals. It's a plea for sending revolutionary socialists there, which, of course, was also the policy of the SPGB at that same time. I mean, in the book, it's not Owen, but Barrington, in the great oration, who explains what the alternative to the capitalist system is, which is called socialism, or the cooperative commonwealth. Now, this term cooperative commonwealth as an alternative for socialism also appears in the early numbers of the Socialist Center. I think it's quite a good term, actually, because it succeeds in bringing out that socialism will involve cooperation, not competition, and also that wealth will be commonly owned by the community. Now, Noonan Trussell, his conception of socialism is heavily based on Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, which, although it upset William Morris when it came out in 1888 and provoked him into writing News from Nowhere as an alternative vision of socialism, did express how many socialists at the time did see socialism. I mean, the means of production, as land and industry, are owned in common, but they're operated by an industrial army, which everybody has to serve from age 21 to age 45. Production is for use, not profit, and an abundance of useful things is produced. Access to this abundance of wealth is by means of what Trussell calls paper money. In fact, in Bellamy, it's more like a credit card, which is issued to everybody in equal amounts. Now, these tokens, whatever they are, cannot be accumulated, since they become worthless if they're not spent within a certain period. So, I mean, although Noonan, through Barrington, uses this term paper money, it's clear that it's intended to be something quite different from money as we know it. It's more in line with the Labour time vouchers Marx once mentioned in passing. In fact, it's not as bad as these, since it doesn't involve trying to measure an individual's contribution to production, which is not measurable anyway, since production today is a collective effort. I mean, and everybody is given the same amount just because they are human beings and returning for serving 24 years in the industrial army. And the longer term aim is that more and more services should be free. Well, that's the conception of socialism that's given in this book. Now, I hasten to add that even at the time, the SPGB did not see socialism as involving service in a so-called industrial army, nor distribution being based on cards entitling people to have an equal access or to access to an equal amount of goods and services. I mean, that was not how we understood the old socialist slogan, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. However, I mean, that Noonan Trussell was a revolutionary socialist in the Anglo-Marxist tradition, doesn't seem to have caused a problem for reformist Labourites. I mean, they've misread Noonan's equal opposition to both Liberals and Tories, making the case for a Labour Party. Now, Noonan was certainly pleading for the formation of an independent working-class party, but a socialist one rather than a mere Labour one. And some Labour supporters have actually distorted Trussell into arguing the case for Labourism. In the year or so, or the years up to the 1992 general election, there was a stage version of the Ragged Trousers of Anthropists which toured Britain. Now, our branch here in West London, we went to see this, I think it must be about 1990, at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith. Now, in this version, the famous by-election is not as it is in the book between the Tory candidate, who has the wonderful name of Sir Graball D'Encloseland, and the Liberal candidate, was called Mr. Adam Sweater, but it's between Sir Graball D'Encloseland and the Labour candidate. And whereas in the book, Owen urges workers to abstain and not vote either Liberal or Tory, not even Liberal to keep out the Tories, in the play he's made reluctantly to say the workers should vote for the Labour candidate. Now, this must have been a deliberate ploy by the pro-Labour people who adapted the book for the stage, to try to convince left-wingers, ex-Trotskyists and others who stopped voting Labour to start doing so again. Now, if Labour MPs base their assessment of the book on this play, it's no wonder that they used to give it as their favourite book. Now, Leninists, on the other hand, have tended to correctly understand what Noonan's approach was, which was trying to convince workers by reasoned argument to become socialists, regarding those who supported capitalism as mugs. And, you know the Leninists say that we disagree with this on two grounds. First, they don't believe that most workers are capable of understanding socialism anyway, and so don't see any point in trying to put a reasoned case for socialism to them. And second, they don't want to come out and describe non-socialist workers as mugs, because they want to flatter them so as to be able to exploit their discontent and become their political leaders. In other words, although in fact they do regard workers as mugs incapable of understanding socialism, they want them, they need them as followers. Now, in a book to be published later this month, Dave Harker, who's a member of the SWP, develops the Leninist case against Tressel by denouncing his abstract propagandism and claiming that his book has only been popular in periods of working class defeat, when it will appeal to socialists who are inclined to blame the workers for not having been revolutionary or militant enough. Now, according to Harker, Tressel drew on real Hastings stories, but left out or marginalised trade unions, radical traditions and socialist organisations in order to focus on the key problem, as he saw it, inside workers' heads. Such abstract propagandism was in the SDF, SLP and SPGB traditions. If you change the ideas in workers' heads by reasoning, they will somehow change the world. Now, this charge of so-called abstract propagandism is true. This, arguing the case for socialism with fellow workers, was Tressel's approach, and he was right. I mean, the Socialist Standard, the March 1906, is an article on socialism, and this is what the writer says. We're all agreed that the ultimate end of socialist propaganda must be the establishment of a socialist regime through the common holding and common control of all the products of labour. This is to be secured by wresting the means and instruments of production from the possession of the present holders and utilising them for the common good. Right. Then it goes on. To secure this end, it is of course necessary that a very large proportion of the people must be in favour of the change, whereas today, a very minute proportion of the people of this country are thus favourable. Hence it is necessary to propagate our principles in such a manner as to induce their acceptance by those who are now hostile or indifferent to them. I mean, a couple of months later, in July 1906, the Socialist Standard quotes a writer in Clarion as follows. Socialists don't desire to get into Parliament quickly. They desire to make socialists, and they can make socialists best by teaching socialism, not by masquerading as Labour men. Now, the Socialist Standard writer agreed with this approach, but expressed surprise at reading it in Clarion, which was an eclectic journal that normally campaigned for a Labour Party. I think these quotes put the tactical question facing socialists 100 years ago very well. As a minority, should they campaign to try to change workers' ideas, or should they accept workers' ideas more or less as they were and seek to get members of the working class elected to Parliament? Now, like Morris and the Socialist League in the 1880s, the SPGB chose the former. Unfortunately, most others and the working class chose the latter, and we got the Labour Party. Now, ironically, perhaps, although in the pre-First World War period, before it even pretended to be a socialist organisation, Labour was essentially a Labour Party. In other words, its MPs were trade unionists, men from the working class. This was not the case of the Labour Party that emerged in the 1920s and 1930s. Certainly, there were still Labour men and women who were represented, but so were many ex-liberals, including MPs, such as Wedgwood Benn's father. In fact, politically, the Labour Party was a modernised version of the old Liberal Party, you know, the party of progress, of social reform within capitalism, alternating in office with the Tories. I mean, not that the social composition of its MPs was that important. If they'd all been horny-handed sons of toil, it wouldn't have made any difference. The Labour Party would still have failed to deliver any progress towards socialism. It failed, too, to advance the cause of trade unions in the way that the unions expected them to. I don't want to go into, I haven't got the time anyway, but I don't think I need to go into details here. Just simply say that while Thatcher helped undermine the unions in the private sector, Blair now wants to do the same thing for unions in the public sector, hence the talk from amongst some trade union leaders and left-wing MPs about refounding another Labour Party. Now, in our view, this would be the completely wrong road to go down. Labourism has already been tried and failed, and it's important to understand why. It's not because of betrayals or sellouts or through a lack of will or determination or because it's been taken over by a gang of slick lawyers like Blair. It's because the whole concept was flawed. Capitalism is not a system that can be humanised or reformed or transformed into something better. It's a profit system subject to economic laws which can only work in one way, as a profit-making and capital accumulation in the interests of a tiny minority of profit takers. Any party that takes on responsibility for administering the political side of capitalism has to accept this reality and has to give priority to profit making over increasing wages or improving benefits for the majority class of wage and salary earners. Every Labour government since the first one in 1924 has done this, and any government formed by some new reconstituted Labour Party would have to do the same. I mean, that's the way capitalism works, and it's the only way it can work, as the political experience of the 20th century has shown. In other words, the 20th century has demonstrated the soundness of the position taken up by the impossibilists at the beginning of that century. That is, that it's impossible to reform capitalism so to make it work in the interest of the majority, and that therefore what those who want a better society should be doing, in fact, should have done, is to campaign to get the working class to take political action to end capitalism and to replace it by a new and different system, one based on the common ownership and the democratic control of the means of production as the only framework within which production can be geared to make to meet people's needs. In other words, production for use instead of production for profit. Unfortunately, in view of the wrong turn taken 100 years ago, this is still the task of socialists today. I mean, the only consolation is that in the meantime, and this also links up with the discussion earlier, the forces of production have developed immensely, and we've now got a worldwide productive network that can easily provide plenty for every man, woman and child on the planet, which of course makes socialism an ever more practical possibility. Right, thanks.
Nice, thank you very much.